Welcome to Food Psych, a podcast dedicated to critiquing diet and wellness culture and answering your questions about intuitive eating and the anti-diet approach. I'm your host, Christy Harrison, and I'm a registered dietitian, certified intuitive eating counselor, journalist, and author of the books Anti-Diet, The Wellness Trap, and the new Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook, which are all available wherever you get your books or at ChristyHarrison.com/books. That's ChristyHarrison.com/books. And by the way, on this show, we avoid diet culture details like weight and calorie numbers, but we don't censor swear words or other adult language, so listener discretion is advised. Hey there, welcome back to Food Psych. This episode is a Q&A I shared on my other podcast, Rethinking Wellness. It went live there over 12 months ago, and I'm excited to bring it to you here now. If you want to get my most up-to-date content, please become a paid subscriber at rethinkingwellness.substack.com. Meanwhile, I can't wait to share this Q&A with you in just a moment. Intuitive Eating Fundamentals, the online course I created to help you make peace with food, is now available as an evergreen, self-paced course with lifetime access. It teaches you how to recognize and reject diet culture, take pleasure in food and stop fighting your desires, tune back into your body's signals of hunger and fullness, end the restrict binge or restrict rebound cycle, navigate emotional eating and learn new coping skills, and most importantly, I think, avoid turning intuitive eating into a sneaky diet. Sign up now for instant access to hundreds of hours of supportive content, including 13 modules on the principles of intuitive eating, deep dives into how to handle common issues that come up when you're trying to make peace with food, special meditations, journal exercises, and more. Get all the details and sign up at ChristyHarrison.com/course or click the link in the show notes. If you like this podcast, I think you'll love my newest book, The Emotional Eating, Chronic Dieting, Binge Eating, and Body Image Workbook. I co-authored it with therapists Judith Matz and Amy Pershing, longtime leaders in the field of diet culture recovery, binge eating disorder, and trauma-informed care, who are also multi-time fan-favorite guests on this podcast. We joined forces to create a workbook for clinicians and general readers alike that we hope will help you break free from the diet binge or restrict rebound cycle, recognize sneaky diets disguised as wellness plans, better understand the role food plays in your life and in managing emotions, unlearn harmful messages about what and when you're quote-unquote supposed to eat, dispel myths about weight, health, and wellness, and lots more. If any of that sounds interesting, you can learn more and buy the book at ChristyHarrison.com/workbook or click the link in the show notes. And now, without any further ado, let's get into it. Today's Q&A is about food rules. The first part is about food rules I used to follow, and then the second part is about the eating principles, not rules, I do still try to live by. Now here's the question. The person writes, diet culture feeds us a ton of different food rules. What is a food rule you used to stand by, and when did you realize it was nonsense? Before I answer, just a reminder that these answers are for educational and informational purposes only, aren't a substitute for medical or mental health advice, and don't constitute a provider-patient relationship. A decade or two ago, when I was struggling with disordered eating and chronic dieting, I followed so many food rules that it's hard to pick just one to talk about here. But there were a couple that persisted more or less throughout those years, even as others came and went. The first was that I wasn't allowed to eat before a certain time of day or after a certain time of night, basically a version of intermittent fasting that I made up long before that diet went mainstream, based on diet tips from friends who were equally disordered eaters. I would skip or delay meals until I was too ravenous to think straight, and then try to eat small portions the rest of the time in the hopes of losing weight and being quote-unquote healthy. It's no wonder I ended up binge eating most days. It's no wonder I was constantly hungry and constantly thinking about food. That's true of most diets, of course, not just intermittent fasting. Despite proponents' claims that a time-restricted diet somehow makes you less hungry, which is not supported by scientific evidence, diets of any kind tend to lead to increased hunger levels and can trigger binge eating. For some people, those and other side effects may feel worthwhile for the purported health benefits. But with intermittent fasting, as with many diets, those claims aren't borne out in the data. As I reported here before, a 2021 Cochrane Systematic Review analyzed 18 studies, including 1,125 participants, looking at outcomes including weight loss, blood sugar, and cardiovascular disease risk factors like cholesterol, triglycerides, and blood pressure. The review found that in the short term, intermittent fasting led to slightly lower body weight than not dieting, but the difference wasn't big enough to be considered clinically significant. The same was true for systolic blood pressure, but not diastolic blood pressure. There were no differences in blood sugar or any of the other cardiovascular risk factors measured, and the quality of the available evidence was deemed low to very low. In other words, the potential upsides of intermittent fasting are far outweighed by the likely downsides. The other food rule I followed on and off through my years of disordered eating was avoiding gluten. Early in my eating disorder, back in 2003, I developed a host of health problems that left my doctors mystified. I have Hashimoto's thyroiditis, which was diagnosed and treated around that time, but I had persistent symptoms that couldn't be explained by my now normalized thyroid levels: fatigue, constipation, brain fog, digestive issues, dry skin, acne. As I continued to seek help in the conventional healthcare system, a family friend who was into alternative medicine urged me to look at gluten. She'd recently self-diagnosed with a gluten sensitivity and thought that might be at the root of my problems. And when I started reading up on it on non-evidence-based websites and patient message boards, I became convinced that was true, despite multiple tests ruling out celiac disease. I tried a gluten-free diet for 2 weeks and wasn't sure if it helped, but I continued doing it on and off for years, convinced it had to have some effect based on everything I was reading and hearing. I also wrote several articles about the supposed benefits of the gluten-free diet for people without celiac disease, fanning the flames of the nascent gluten-free trend. That's something I think about a lot now when I see diet trend pieces in the media. How many of those journalists are struggling in their own relationships with food, broadcasting their disorder to the masses? I started to realize those food rules weren't working for me when I began seriously addressing my disordered eating in therapy. But at first, I don't think I actually viewed them as nonsense, or at least non-evidence-based. I just thought maybe they weren't the right fit for me, or in my frequent self-critical moments, that I was somehow doing them wrong, that there was something uniquely wrong and broken in me that prevented me from sticking with these diets that so many other people seem to be quote-unquote succeeding with. I started to feel resigned to the fact that I wasn't cut out for dieting, but I wasn't exactly happy about it. A few years later, when I started focusing on disordered eating and my work as a dietitian and journalist, it finally dawned on me that this was not just a me problem. Then I started applying the research method skills I'd learned in grad school to critically unpack the science on gluten, fasting, and diets in general, and I truly came to understand just how little good evidence there was behind the rules I'd tried to follow on and off for a decade. That's when I knew for sure I was done with dieting. My personal experience made me question diet rules, but the science sealed the deal. This is a big part of why my work today focuses on deep dives into scientific research. I want to help people who are already questioning diets and other wellness trends to understand why they don't work and develop a more durable resistance to them. I know science won't move the needle for everyone, but for those whose brains are wired similarly to mine, I hope maybe it can have a similar effect. Today, I no longer follow any food rules or diets. Still, there are a few food-related principles I practice, not in a rigid way, but because they're helpful for self-care. The first one is that when I'm hungry, I try to eat as soon as possible. This doesn't mean that I only ever eat when I'm hungry. Sometimes I eat preemptively because I'm going to be busy during my usual meal or snack time. Sometimes I eat just for pleasure, such as having some cake at a birthday party or dessert after dinner even though I'm full. But on a day-to-day basis, whenever I notice signs of hunger, I make an effort to wrap up whatever I'm doing and get some food. Occasionally, it can be hard to tear myself away from work or other activities when it's time to eat, but I think of it as essential both for fueling my continued engagement in the activity and for preventing any hunger-related crashes that would derail my fun. The second thing I do is I try to eat foods that sustain and satisfy me. Each time I eat, I attempt to serve myself enough to feel truly full, content, and ready to move on to things other than food. In my dieting days, I often used to eat just the bare minimum to take the edge off the hunger, but that left me unsatisfied and yearning for my next meal, and rarely fully present in my life. And it also set me up to binge. In addition to eating enough, I do my best to eat a variety of foods that I actually enjoy. It isn't possible or realistic for every meal and snack to be a 10 out of 10 smash hit, and aiming for that can be its own form of disorder, a sort of gastronomic perfectionism that can interfere with life and mask restrictive behaviors. But to the extent possible within my schedule and budget, I try to have foods available that I like and look forward to eating. I'm fortunate enough to have reliable access to these kinds of foods, and I try not to take that for granted. The third thing is that I've internalized the other principles of intuitive eating. The two aims I mentioned above are among those principles, and intuitive eating is a framework for relating to food and physical activity without the influence of diet culture. And I have a link to the 10 principles in the Substack post that goes with this episode. I also found those principles incredibly helpful in my recovery from disordered eating, which is why I eventually went on to become a certified intuitive eating counselor after getting my registered dietitian's license. I generally live by intuitive eating principles today, though I don't always actively think about them unless I'm teaching them to clients or students. For example, I don't really need to challenge the food police anymore in my own life, because after more than a decade of recovery, those voices, thankfully, are no longer present for me. There are many misconceptions about intuitive eating, as I covered in a 2020 piece for Self about intuitive eating myths, so that's worth reading if you want to learn more about the finer points. As for the science behind intuitive eating, there are nuances to that too. There isn't a huge number of randomized controlled trials of intuitive eating and related frameworks, but there are a few that show intuitive eating results in better health outcomes than conventional diets on some measures, and similar outcomes on others, and far better adherence over time than dieting. A strong body of observational evidence also links intuitive eating to beneficial outcomes like positive body image, self-esteem, and well-being, and lower levels of disordered eating and anxiety and depression symptoms. But of course, with the observational data, we can't know for sure if those associations are cause or effect. It's possible that people who already feel better about themselves and their bodies just naturally eat more intuitively, and that their good health has more to do with their overall well-being than their eating style. I'd say it's probably a bit of both. Intuitive eating is a helpful approach in some ways, and in others, it's maybe simply a marker of greater well-being. Ultimately, I think of intuitive eating as a conservative approach, not politically conservative, but medically conservative. It's an approach of doing less, intervening less. And given the shaky state of the science behind most interventions, I think that's a good thing. Intuitive eating is less invasive than diets. It doesn't dictate what to eat or not to eat, when to eat, how much to eat, and it doesn't force people to override their hunger and their desires and end up rebound binging as a result. It doesn't endorse restricting calories, carbs, fat, or anything else. It doesn't prescribe how many hours you should go between meals or how many plants to eat in a week. In situations where there's no solid evidence for most interventions, as with diets, and especially when many of the available interventions carry significant risks, like the risk of disordered eating posed by diets, I think a conservative approach is often the best because it tends to carry the least likelihood of harm. So to me, given the state of the evidence, intuitive eating feels like a safer bet than dieting. Finally, the fourth general principle I practice is that I try not to blame food for my symptoms. It would be easy to pin my occasional afternoon fatigue on the pasta I ate for lunch, but when I really get curious, there's usually a better explanation. I was up late with a sick toddler. I woke up to a noise at 3 a.m. and couldn't fall back asleep, which is a true story that happened to me last night. I've been slogging through PubMed for hours and my brain needs a break. I stayed up too late watching Hacks. Plus, there are days when I eat pasta for lunch and feel fine in the afternoon, and other days when I eat a supposedly more energizing meal and feel wiped out. The relationship between food and energy levels isn't nearly as simple as we've been led to believe. Similarly, as I've shared here before, when my IBS and other digestive issues flare up, I try to recognize everything other than food that affects my digestion. Stress, lack of sleep, chronic conditions like the Hashimoto's, side effects from medications, hormonal ups and downs, and any other changes or disruptions in routine. I make an effort to address these other factors to the extent that I can, instead of pointing the finger at food. Of course, there are rare cases where genuine food allergies or intolerances truly are to blame for symptoms, and I don't want to discount those. But barring those experiences, I think it's worth considering that something other than food is probably the cause of your symptoms. There are also sadly many cases where people come to believe they have a food allergy or intolerance because of misinformation or dubious diagnosis from an alternative provider when they actually don't, and that's a messy and difficult situation that I know all too well. It's really hard to be scientific about ourselves, especially when diet and wellness culture have conditioned us for decades to believe that food is the source of all our struggles, the root cause of every symptom. But to the extent that it's possible to step back and observe ourselves in a somewhat neutral way, it can be powerful to recognize that there are potential explanations for what ails us that have nothing to do with food. Thanks so much to the person who asked this question. And if you want to ask one of your own for a chance to have it answered in an upcoming Q&A, you can go to christyharrison.com/questions. If you found this podcast helpful, I'd be so grateful if you take a moment to subscribe, rate, and review it on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. You can see all the places to subscribe at christyharrison.com/subscribe. It's christyharrison.com/subscribe. If you're looking for help healing your own relationship with food, grab my free audio guide, 7 Simple Strategies for Finding Peace and Freedom with Food. Just go to christyharrison.com/strategies to get it. That's christyharrison.com/strategies. To get full show notes and a transcript of this episode, go to christyharrison.com/foodpsych. And to get the transcript, find the episode page and scroll down to the bottom to enter your email address. A big thanks to Softer Sounds for audio editing and production, and to administrative assistant Julianne Witasik for helping me out with all the moving parts that go into producing this show. Our album art was photographed by Abby Moore Photography, and the logo was designed by Melissa Alam. Our theme song was written and performed by Carolyn Pennypacker Riggs, and I'm your host and executive producer, Christy Harrison. Thanks again for listening, and until next time, stay psyched.